agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University. I'm joined today by Ken Katkin, a professor of law at Chase Law School. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Oh, it's great to be back, Trey.
It's always fun to be back. Today we get to see that we have the same haircut, and that made me really happy. I don't know why that made me happy.
Yeah. But then we never knew that before.
This week, Ken, I think one of the big items that we're going to want to jump to right off the bat happened way back on Monday night. Monday night, kind of maybe surprisingly, maybe not, the Senate parliamentarian ruled that Democrats could have a third budget reconciliation bill in a single year. Now, this is kind of really big news because, generally speaking, we've thought you've only been able to have two. So how do we get from two to three? Well, the idea is that you can pass a revised budget resolution, and the revised budget resolution can contain budget reconciliation instructions. In other words, it's another device to pass something via reconciliation. Now, policymakers have enacted 21 budget reconciliation bills since 1980, the first year they employed the process. Congress approved four other measures, but the president has vetoed them in the past. Now, the White House is undoubtedly hoping that this is going to be a vehicle for the American Jobs Plan, which is President Biden's infrastructure proposal. And so I thought we'd probably need to talk a little bit about that as well, because this is a $2.65 trillion plan concentrated over the next 8 years and combined with a little bit of a tax increase, which does not cover the entire cost of the plan, but hopes to bring the bill closer to revenue neutral. Spread out over 10 years, the plan would increase the deficit by approximately $900 billion. So I thought we could talk a little bit about that on both fronts. So Ken, why don't we start by talking about the budget reconciliation process and the parliamentarian's ruling, and then I thought maybe we could move on and talk a little bit about the infrastructure bill that I think Biden is hoping might be what the Senate uses that third reconciliation process for.
Yeah, actually, on the process, it's even more remarkable than you said, because as you said, this will let the Dems do three spending bills this year. Now, it's not normally two. It's normally one. The only reason it was even going to be two this year is because when McConnell was still running the Senate in the fall, they didn't get a 2021 budget done. So
they can do a current and a future year, effectively.
So in 2021, the Dems were going to have the chance to do the 2021, which they already did in the form of the COVID stimulus bill, and then the 2022, which they could do over the summer for the next fiscal year. But this lets them do another one in between. So I'm pleased with it. We talked about that last time we were on together.
Yes.
And I was hoping this would happen because I think as we've seen that there's not really 50 votes to overrule a parliamentarian among the Dems, you know, and so I think it a whole lot does depend on how the parliamentarian rules on these matters, even though the 50 Dems plus Kamala Harris, if they were willing to do it, they have the power to overrule any parliamentarian's ruling. So normally it doesn't really matter what the parliamentarian says, but under these unique political circumstances, I think it does.
Yeah, I mean, generally you don't hear a lot about parliamentarians because, as you know, the Senate they get to have the final decision-making process on their own procedure. It's always interesting because one of the things I think that average individuals might not always think about is the unique processes of both the Senate and the House, right? They have their own unique processes. The Constitution gives them the right to create their own rules. The Senate considers themselves this permanent body, but they have all of these kinds of, I think sometimes we think of as being arcane rules, but you're right. Parliamentarians make rulings on a regular basis, but they don't make national news because, of course, if you don't like it, you say, well, the parliamentarian's wrong. Here's what the process is.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually how we got the elimination of the filibuster for judicial appointments and for executive appointments. The Senate never did change those rules. According to the text of those rules, all of those confirmations are filibusterable. But when the parliamentarian, you know, ruled as they always have in the past, you know, these are filibusterable. What was called the nuclear option was when the Senate voted to overrule those rulings. So that is how those changes were made.
Right. And that's always a good point. The nuclear option is when you are taking a vote to undo or change the rules or the processes by which you apply in the Senate, at least. You can't do that in the House in the same way.
Right. Right. In the House, actually, each piece of legislation that's going to be voted in the House starts by they have to vote for what are the rules going to be by which this particular piece of legislation proceeds. So that's different than in the Senate, where they have standing rules.
That's absolutely true. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why, even kind of in an intro way, in the House, the most powerful committee is, in fact, the Rules Committee, because the Rules Committee is the group that gets the chance to put their fingerprints all over, well, what are going to be the rules of debate for each and every piece of legislation that comes along. In the Senate, because they act by unanimous consent, that means that that there's going to be uniform processes unless you have somebody who objects, which leads to this whole process of potentially having a filibuster and what we're talking about here, potentially undoing a parliamentarian ruling.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the other thing about the process, I just want to say although there's supposed to normally be only one spending bill a year on reconciliation, but now this ruling means there could actually be three this year. There's also that same non-filibusteral reconciliation process is also available for one taxing bill and for one bill to raise the debt ceiling. So those kinds of bills
can't there be three, because it's debt ceiling, taxing, and spending.
Yeah, but these are the spending. So spending, there's going to be three now, because the first one, the COVID stimulus bill, was the spending bill that we could think of as formally being the federal budget bill for the year 2021.
I thought that they had ruled that all three of those elements were in that one reconciliation, and therefore, because generally speaking, you could have three, but in the past, the history has been that all three of those elements were tied up in one reconciliation bill, and therefore you didn't get all three. I think that bill actually counted once for all three of those boxes. Because
you could be right about that. I didn't know that they raised any taxes in the stimulus bill. But if they did,
and what it does to raise tax, it doesn't always have to be a specific tax increase, but I'd have to look at those rules a little bit more carefully again, Ken, but things fall into that taxing bucket that are not necessarily, I think, what the average individual would say, oh, that's a tax increase. Things that end up affecting the deficit in certain ways can be, I believe, a tax. But that, we're starting to get pretty arcane. We're a little bit more granular than I'm familiar with right off the top of my head.
the key big takeaway for listeners is that in a process that can normally be only done once a year for big spending bills is going to be able to be done three times this year.
Yes. Yes. So now, why don't we talk? I know that last week they spent a little bit of time talking about it, so we don't have to spend a lot of time here. But this is undoubtedly going to be the vehicle that the Biden administration hopes is going to be his infrastructure plan, technically what's called the American Jobs Plan. And I'm curious a little bit about your take on this. To see if you think this is what the White House is going to want to put through reconciliation. And then two, you know, this is an area where we had some disagreement a couple of weeks ago when we went. And I think we're going to probably have a little more disagreement in a minute when we talk a little bit about some tax proposals coming from Schumer. So what are your initial thoughts on the Biden jobs plan?
Well, you know, I can't say I've read all the different parts of it. There's quite a lot in there.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Like even when you're just doing the summary of it, you know, there's about seven major broad categories, even before you get down to the details.
So I can just say that the overall approach of it is one that I'm very happy about. I'm sure, you know, if you go through it with a fine tooth comb, you'll be able to point out things in there that I might come around to agreeing with you know, or could be wasteful spending. But I think that I think that if you think about it systemically rather than kind of chopping away at the individual provisions, you know, I think the idea of a major spending bill that's designed not only to do traditional infrastructure like roads and bridges and things and or information infrastructure like broadband deployment, but also stuff that looks a lot less like traditional infrastructure, like investments in human capital and things like that.
Historically black colleges, for example. Yeah.
Yeah. I think all of that is good. I think it's good that there's going to be a lot of spending on that. And I think it's good that there's going to be tax increases that are going to pay substantially for most of it, and that they are really going to be, I think, targeted in the right places. It's going to be on business corporations and on people who earn above $400,000, and I'm for all of that.
You know, I mean, and sticking kind of with the broad strokes, because I think you're going the right direction there. I don't disagree with you on the front that I don't mind, you know, even from my kind of, you know, my libertarian point of view, I don't mind targeted kinds of spending. I do wish, though, that on the broad strokes, not without being nitpicky, that we could, in fact, have a bill that would be net neutral. And specifically, for example, you know, just as a quick look, you could say, well, if you just took out of this bill the $400 billion on home health care things, just right there, that would bring the bill to being a little bit more than, as a matter of fact, revenue neutral. And so this is one of the things that I think continues to bother me, is that I really wish that Democrats would kind of live up to their rhetoric of, we're going to spend money, but we're going to collect that money as well, right? And so from my libertarian side, especially when we see this is coming in, you know, we had talked about it a couple of weeks ago, once again, a bill, this one coming, again, $2.65 trillion, right? So again, we're talking in terms of levels of debt. As a matter of fact, I looked at the Brookings, because I knew that, you know, I kind of take a left view, so I like to kind of, or excuse me, I take a right view. So I wanted to kind of see, well, what does the left kind of summarize on this bill? And, you know, even Brookings, which is going to be a little bit more liberal of a source, has argued that before this bill was going to go into place and before the last round of stimulus spending, that we were already on track to hit 118% of GDP as deficit in 9 years. And so I know that maybe I hammer on the deficit a little bit harder. It's something that I hammered on with Republicans when they wanted to do it with tax cuts. But I see this being the same kind of fundamental systemic issue that Republicans had, only Democrats are, I think, a little cooler about it now because it's spending, which is their priority, as opposed to tax cuts, which is Republicans of priority.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm going to say only 50% disagree with you and 50% agree with you here, because I think, I'm more of a Keynesian, and I think right now the economy is in transition from the pandemic economy, which needed quite a lot of help, into an economy that's probably going to be pretty good again in a year or two. And I agree with you that in the times of the boom, as opposed to the times of the bust, the budgets should be balanced. And I think we're moving there. Now, I think that the if you look at what the, you know, I don't want to just do straight whataboutism here, but when the Trump tax cut came in 2017, that's $1.7 trillion in revenue cuts, and mm-hmm. there were no spending cuts, right? Now, here, there's...
And I agree with you on that, 100%.
Yeah. So here there's $2.6 trillion in spending increases, but I think about 1.9 billion of it is paid for roughly by these tax increases. So it's a smaller increase in the deficit. And also,
if you took it alone in isolation, I think I'd be more willing to kind of move in your direction. But of course, you know, we already had this conversation on another bill, right? So you start adding those together is what you end up having to do for a particular administration. And we're just 100 days in.
Yeah, that's right. But also we're still in the COVID economy. So I think that as a Keynesian, I think it was okay that they did the stimulus bill with a lot of spending that wasn't paid for during a time when there was a huge hole in the economy. I think it really depends to me that it's okay to deficit spend in the depths of the business cycle. You got to balance it up in the booms in the business cycle. And so I think we are, you know, that stimulus bill actually is part of the reason why the economy is going to rapidly recover right now. You know, that, that people are going to be able to spend money, even if they weren't earning that much money over the past year. So you know, people have pent up demand, but they also need money to pay for the things they have pent up demand for. And I think that that was a wise time to take on some debt. I also think, you know, this could wind up being more paid for than it may look like today, because one thing that is sort of a work in progress now is I think Biden's kind of put it out there that he would like to see some bipartisanship, but that he's willing to go on a partisan basis if necessary. And that was really, yeah. So if you think about relating that issue back to this issue of deficit spending, you know, I think that, you know, if Republican, I think the deficit is in part built into this so that the tax, so that the tax increases won't even be higher, you know, and I think if no Republicans come on board, you know, then it's very possible that this, the shape of this could go towards, like, instead of taking the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28, maybe it'll go all the way back to 35, which is what it was before the 2017 tax cuts. You know, some other things are being talked about that aren't in the Biden plan, but that some Democrats in the Congress are talking about, like equilibrating the rates for capital gains income with the rates for ordinary income. And so there are some proposals in Congress that would raise more taxes and that would close up that budget hole. And I think that, you know, those are kind of being held back in hopes that, well, Republicans don't want any of that. And maybe if some Republicans will actually join, then we won't do any of that. But if no Republicans are going to join anyhow, you know, you were talking about cutting the spending on home health care. But I think Democrats on a partisan basis would say, no, we're not going to do that. The way we're going to close the budget hole is just by raising a few other taxes on corporations and on rich people. And I think that could be in reserve as part of what you'll see if it's another purely partisan bill.
I'm not usually the one on the show that makes predictions, but my prediction is that none of the proposals that may be waiting in the wings from Democrats are going to even come close to covering just the cost of the things they've increased, you know, that they will increase over the course of the Biden administration. And I don't say that as trying to hammer on Democrats specifically, but no administration, you have to go back to a weird Republican Congress, Democrat president during Clinton, the last time that we've really seen that kind of will to have a more, or as you put it, during the good times, let's make sure that we're, you know, being revenue neutral on that front. I don't think it's likely in the current political environment. I mean, because who's going to want to suffer the political fallout from having a higher taxes?
Well, no, I'm not saying that that this Congress is going to get us into budget surplus. I'm just saying that they're going to get this particular spending bill perhaps into surplus, right? We're only about the 2.65.
Yeah, exactly. I don't mean the whole. Yeah. I agree. Yeah, so I'm talking about the same thing. I don't think we're even going to see the bills that we have seen over the course of the last 100 days. I don't think we're going to see revenue that equals that amount of spending, given the total amount of that spending and what it is. Because again, as we talked about, even just the third round of COVID relief was approximately the size of a fiscal budget year. I mean, the likelihood that you're going to see tax increases or loophole decreases that will equal just that amount, right? So not the whole, I agree with you, let's kind of put the whole deficit aside for a minute, just the new spending revenue items, including things, if assuming that they use reconciliation on the Jobs Act as it is.
I think it's doable, and I don't think there'd be so much political. I mean, the whole thing about whether it's done on a partisan basis or a bipartisan basis is political fallout from Republicans becomes irrelevant if Republicans aren't going to join the bill, aren't going to willing to negotiate to that they might vote for the bill. I don't think I don't think there's been any political fallout against the first stimulus bill that the Dems passed a few months ago, and I don't think it would be much different if they passed one now that spent on a lot of popular spending programs and that raised all that money to pay for it entirely by taxing corporations and people who earn more than $400,000. I just think that the Democrats are for all that. There's not going to be a fallout against that.
So if there's no, I mean, if we took that line of reasoning and we said, look, there's not going to be a fallout on it. So when you say they're holding it back, do you think that they're waiting? And well, so if Republicans won't come on board with this particular bill, they're going to modify the bill to put the spending items, to put the revenue generating items into this particular bill during reconciliation?
Possibly. I think there'll be amendments offered that way. You know, I don't know which way they'll go, but I think Biden's also trying to signal that the reverse is also true. So this may exacerbate your concerns about budget busting. But I think, you know, Biden keeps saying I'm very open to compromise. And I think it's true. Like, I think if a Republican senator would actually vote for the bill, if Biden agreed, OK, instead of raising the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28, I'll just raise it from 21 to 25 if that'll get me your vote. You know, I think Biden would make that deal, you know, and so I think if Republicans will come on board, it's probably going to bust the budget even more. Right. But I think if the Republicans are going to turn away, you know, and say we're not coming on board no matter what, then there's no reason to lower it from 28 to 25. And in fact, there may be, you know, amendments to raise it
higher,
put it even higher. Yeah.
Well, you know, since we're talking budget and we're talking these items, you know, one of the other things that I thought we would talk about this week is the salt tax. But before we get to the salt tax, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors, and then we're going to be back and we're going to talk about the salt tax. Okay, so Ken, one of the items that we had that we wanted to chat about was changes to the salt tax. I was a little surprised this week because it was one that I think kind of flew under the radar. I shared it with our Discord user. So for those of you who are part of our Discord group, you're that level of supporter. We get on and do things for the show regularly. And I had shared a National Review piece. It was the one that actually brought it originally to my attention. Then I went and took a look at his. But Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's goal is to repeal the limits of the state and local tax deduction, or what we call SALT. What this is in 2017, there were tax reform limits placed on SALT. SALT is a deduction that allows citizens to write off their state and local tax bills when calculating their federal taxes. It effectively lowers the federal taxes for those who face higher taxes locally and who simultaneously itemize taxes. So Schumer and joined with Gillibrand pushed was to end because in 2017, SALT was capped at $10,000 and they want to make it unlimited again. According to their own press release, Gillibrand goes so far as to argue that capping at $10,000 is, quote, a cynical policy passed by Republicans, end quote. Specifically, Democrats argue it is being taxed twice on the same income. Now, I'm going to take some issue with that particular view, but I know that you take a different view. So what do you think about this move? I mean, since we were already talking a little bit about taxes, isn't this kind of the opposite of what you were just arguing, that the Democrats are going to be willing to increase revenue generating on higher income earners? Here's an example of where they'd actually, for their own constituents, like to lower it.
Well, this isn't an issue of it's partly, of course, an issue of wealthier versus lower income taxpayers, as you say. But I think it's primarily an issue of whether blue state taxpayers have to contribute by even one more mechanism so much more than their fair share, which they already were even before this. And then this just shifted it that much more to the blue states. I mean, states like California, New Jersey, New York are overwhelmingly already paying for the whole federal government. People in those states are paying so much more and getting so much less from Washington than people in the red states. And then this was just a Republican
that
measure.
That is what the redistributive policy is all about, though, right? You take it from certain higher income areas, and certainly California and New York, if you're going to have progressive redistribution of policies, they're going to move it from a lot of high urban, high income centers to lower poor areas.
Yeah, that's fine, but it's and that's fine, but this is about only putting extra taxes on people who live in states that have higher taxes.
Well, it's not extra taxes. What you're asking for, this would be an example of an exemption from taxes. Extra taxes would be to say, well, if you live in a state with a certain amount of whatever, we're going to charge you more than we charge the average person. This actually allows you to reduce your tax liability by the amount that you pay in state and local taxes. So that would actually be, I mean, that's a tax cut.
No, because people who have to pay higher taxes don't get that money that they're paying in taxes. So they're having to pay double taxes on money they never get.
But that's, I mean, that's historically always been, I mean, that is maybe one of the curses of federalism is the fact that one sovereign entity's tax rate does not interfere with the other sovereign entity's tax rate, which has long been a potential sore point or a complaint. I agree.
No, the Internal Revenue Code for certainly my whole lifetime, I think for as long as it's been around, has until they changed it in 2017, did allow a deduction for state and local taxes. I think 2017 was the first time that the federal government tried to tax money.
Doesn't that start in the 1980s?
No.
No, when does that start?
Well, I long time ago.
I'd have to look at that. I don't know that one off the top of my head, but I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, that I think for as long as there have been income tax rates, I mean, maybe in the very earliest days when the income tax rates were only 1%, it wasn't like that. But for as long as we've had significant federal income tax rates, the money that was paid in state and local taxes has not been taxed. This was a dramatic change from precedent.
But of course, this is a tax cut that is specifically for wealthier individuals. I mean, what's fascinating about this to me is it feeds into the true narrative here, which is that it's not really about revenue generation and it's not really about redistributionist policies. It's about specific redistributionist policies for Democrats. They want redistributionist policies for particular individuals, not individuals in their own constituencies. For example, SALT does not help the average individual. The average individual is taking a standard deduction and therefore is not eligible for SALT. You have to be making enough money for itemized deductions, which means you are at least upper middle class before that's going to become a real and true possibility for you on taxes, right? I mean,
no, I don't agree with that. The average homeowner was taking these deductions because property taxes are part of it. So if you've got particularly the average two-income family that owns a home, so I think substantially all two-income families that own a home in a state that has an income tax would have taken this deduction. Now, you could say that everybody who fits that category is at least upper middle class, but
yes,
I'm not.
They would be.
You think every household that has two working adults owns a home.
Even if you're making a relatively low amount of money individually, so let's say you're making $50,000 a year per couple, you're now making over $100,000 a year as a unit, and that firmly puts you in the upper middle class once you hit $100,000. Now, I will agree that doesn't put you in kind of the ultra wealthy category, but you have certainly hit a new level of income. I don't think we disagree on that particularly.
Well, right, it wasn't something used by poor people, but I think it was used by a lot of middle class people. I mean, the American tax policy has promoted home ownership, and so the idea of promoting home ownership, you know, that's something that's going to benefit people who actually become homeowners. But there's social benefits, I think, in promoting homeownership.
Well, it benefits certain social homeowners. It benefits social homeowners in particularly expensive states where homeownership is a large proportion of your bill. It also, as you noted, encourages certain kinds of individuals. So individuals where two family members are working, or you happen to have a single income household that has a particularly high bill. So, I mean, I'm not saying that you can't make a case for that. What I'm saying, though, is that this clearly flies in the face of that idea of having a progressive redistributed tax code, right? I mean, the idea that somebody at the $100,000 level is going to receive a tax cut and that's going to be a big item for Schumer in a year where we already have deficit spending shows that I don't think he's as committed to this progressive ideal as he really says he is. That's one of my problems with Democrats.
It's wrong. You're wrong, because someone who earns even a two working person household that earns $100,000, to use your example, if they have to live in New York or California, which are expensive places, and they have to pay a lot for a home already, and they're already, you know, their state, you know, is everybody in their state is contributing more Then those states are getting back, and all that money is being sent over to the red states. It's just extra punitive. It's just extra punitive.
I like that you use that word punitive. I'm going to agree. I don't disagree with you. There is a nature of punitive, but once you start talking about that in terms of being punitive, you've come over to my side, right? And you're suggesting that tax imbalances at a certain level actually become punishments. Well,
no, because
if you take
not...
that view, you're on a libertarian. You're welcome to libertarian land.
No, because it's not based on the thing that's punitive is that it's specifically designed to punish people for living in blue states. That's what's punitive about it. It's not about their income level. People in New York and California were always willing to pay more taxes than everybody else, but it's just extra punitive to say, you know, it's not because you're earning more income that you have to pay more taxes. You have to pay more because you're earning more income, and then you have to pay an extra even more because you happen to live in New York or California.
Well, but of that's course, the, punitive the part extra of it. Is because your state has opted to have a particular tax bracket that is higher than other states. I mean, that's only punitive in the sense that those states elected individuals who have, according to their constituents, placed a tax rate that is at the rate that it is for New York or California, whereas other states in their representatives working for their votes have placed tax rates at different levels. So to suggest that then because you also have to pay the federal tax rate says, well, if I'm going to tax myself a lot locally, well, then I should get a national break because, well, of course, I have to have higher New York's state tax. Well, of course, you don't have to have higher New York state tax. New Yorkers have opted via their representatives, and rightfully so. There's nothing wrong with that, to have the tax rates that they have. But I don't see why that should give them... So. Each of these states.
Let me come at this a different way.
Yeah.
Because I'll just use California this time, although I'm from New York. But because California.
Wait, aren't you from Ohio?
Okay, I live in Ohio now. But actually, this punishes me even in Ohio because Ohio is a fairly average state for both state income tax and state local property tax. But I get hurt even here in Ohio by the salt cap. But I wanted to put it more in terms of California. Because California has been willing to invest in good public education, the University of California system, in good roads so people can get around, in some mass transit projects so people can get to work, that those investments have actually enabled Californians to make higher income. And because those investments enable Californians to make higher income, Californians are already paying more tax than people in other states because they have higher income than people in other states. But they have that higher income because their state made those investments. So California's higher taxes actually yields benefits to everybody outside of California because it produces a state full of people who can earn higher income and pay higher tax on that higher income.
So effectively, what you're trying to get away from here is, so because of the choices of states, and they can be good ones, I'm not disagreeing with you. So California is a great example. They have decided to invest more than many other states in the surrounding West, for example, in education. They do have a very large and highly funded university system. And so because of that, they have benefits like now being higher income earners. Okay,
and they pay federal taxes on that higher
exactly.
income.
Exactly, but that's progressive. That is progressivism. Progressivism says you make more money, you pay more taxes.
Yeah, so I think that's fine. I just don't think it's good to penalize people because they live in a state that made those investments.
In your view, then the state that made the best. So let's say you had a state where everybody became a billionaire. I mean, you could say woohoo, but if you're a progressive, you're still going to have to argue that those billionaires need to pay their fair share of progressive taxes. And that would mean that the people in that state would be paying a higher percentage than the rest of the states. True, but that is a redistributive policy.
Yeah, I'm for that. I think they should pay higher if they're billionaires. I'm just saying they shouldn't pay an extra penalty above that because they're billionaires who live in California that billionaires in Texas wouldn't have to pay.
Well, I mean, so because what you're trying to say is that, I mean, ultimately, you don't like the fact that some states have determined via their own legislatures to have lower, oftentimes, maybe let's even using that logic, worse particular outcomes in their state. But because they're doing it that way, they don't have as high taxes. Therefore, they're getting some kind of advantage.
They are getting a huge advantage because...
Well, they're getting one advantage, but even in your argument, they're losing out on these other things, right? They're not getting the investments in education system. They don't have the same kinds of road systems. They don't have those things because, of course, their state wasn't taxed. So if your argument is
true... And then they get them because they're subsidized by everybody from the blue states, which they are. You know, there are interstate highways in red states, and that's because they're paid for by people in blue states. They do get those benefits, and they get them as transfer payments already.
I see, I'm going to have to disagree on this one. This is one where I think we actually just have a fundamental disagreement in that you're all for redistributive policies until it happens to be the case that a blue state would be subsidizing red states in major ways because, well, I don't like the fact that red states are winning out in this particular redistributive process.
Let me look at some actual numbers here before we move away from this. I just found these on the internet. So let me look at, for instance, New York and New Jersey, and then you can pick some red states I should look at. But okay. I'm going to tell you the numbers that are how much more do the federal taxpayers in these states send to Washington than what they get back from Washington. So New Jersey sends $24.7 billion more to Washington than it gets back. And that's $2,748 per capita that New Jersey sends to Washington more than it gets back. For New York, it's $24.1 billion, and that's $1,216 per capita more than it gets back. Now, if you just name any red state, you know, I'll tell you the number for that state.
Take a look at Florida.
All right. Florida. Just take me a second to get here. Okay. Florida. Florida receives $62.4 billion more than it sends. And that's receiving $2,977 per person more than it sends. So there's this massive transfer from New York and New Jersey to Florida already. And all this salt cap does is just make that even more extreme. And there's plenty of billionaires in Florida, by the way.
I don't disagree. But see, here's what I want to hammer, though, is that I hear you and I agree with the frustration that you have there. But what I'm suggesting is that the frustration is born of the fact that redistributive policies create winners and losers that are frustrating for the winners and losers, and that nobody ever wants to fall on the losing side. So I don't disagree with you. I mean, that's not fair in my sense of fair. So I don't, you know, I'm not attempting to argue that. But in the sense that if we're going to take the ethos that we need to have redistributive policies, then pointing out that there are imbalances, they're either going to be to have a redistributive policy, it either has to be regional, it has to be some kind of categorical distinction between somebody is putting in, some groups of somebodies are putting in a lot more than other groups of somebodies, and you're going to always be able to slice it up, again, either categorically or regionally. Who's the winner or the loser? I mean, how else would you do that?
Well, I think that's formally correct, but substantively wrong. Because okay. I think formally your logic is right, but I think the reason I'd say it's still substantively wrong is because there's certain I think moral principles for redistribution that are acceptable to people who are on the giving end. Like my household is an above average income household. I agree that above average income households should pay more in taxes, and that should be redistributed to poorer people. It bothers me not at all that I pay more taxes than a lot of people who have less money than me. I think that's perfectly fair. But I think the design of the 2017 limitation on salt taxes was to say, well, because Republicans took control, they want to find a way to make Democrats pay more taxes than Republicans, or at least people who live in Democratic states, and that's the design of the salt tax limitation. I don't think that's a morally fair basis for redistribution the way rich to poor is a morally fair basis of redistribution.
Well, I guess the last thing I'll kind of say is while I understand that you're making that moral distinction, My suggestion is that even if we take the states that you have listed out, I don't know how you would create a system in which, because California, New York, especially, where have some of the most, you know, the largest population and earning centers and some of the largest capital centers, I don't know how you're going to have a system that won't also be regional in the sense of moving from blue to red, given the wealth distribution between red and blue states. Now, your point earlier, I'm not even attempting to disagree with, right? I mean, you might have these higher taxes to do it. But if we're trying to meet that moral principle that you're talking about, I'm not sure how you do it without having a tax system that, however you slice it, will send money from some major blue states to a lot of red states.
Yeah, I'm fine sending money from major blue states to red states if it's based on wealth. And that's what was already happening before 2017. But I just don't like the piling on and saying it's not just going to be wealthy to poor. It's going to be wealthy to poor. Plus, it's going to also be blue to red on top of wealthy to poor.
I think those categories are so overlapping. It's going to be difficult to actually distinguish that.
Just repeal the salt tax cap and then you've distinguished them. I think that's all you need to do. Oh, one last thing on this. Then we need to move on. I think President Biden actually already said, because he was hearing the kinds of things that you're saying, that he's actually open to the idea of of maintaining the $10,000 cap for the taxpayers who are over $400,000, right? So that he would only repeal it for the taxpayers who are under $400,000.
Yeah.
So that might be a way to satisfy what both of us are saying, actually.
And that's true. And that's true. And it's also always a little bit ironic because we undoubtedly probably fall in different tax brackets as well. Yeah. Okay. So now maybe we'll move away from something. It's fun though, when we get a little contentious every now and then. Yes. So listeners, you guys always seem to point this out. You're like, this is the time. Yeah. So what we're going to move to next, we're going to have a break, but we're going to move to Biden's this Friday. President Biden released his gun control executive orders. So we're going to be taking that on in just a minute. Biden's gun control executive orders. We come back from this break. Okay, so we're going to be talking about Biden's gun control orders. As a matter of fact, on Thursday, Biden announced that, quote, this administration will not wait for Congress to act and will take steps its own concerning gun violence. And it has taken over the last 24 hours six immediate actions that they have released. One, they have issued that the Justice Department needs to have a proposed rule in the next 30 days to stop the proliferation of so-called ghost guns. This is weapons that can be, or the pieces to weapons that can be purchased and then assembled once you have a receiver. So you can actually ship all the pieces but a receiver around the country. That doesn't count as a weapon. So that's what number one is really about. The second is to have the Justice Department issue a proposed rule to make clear when a device marketed as a stabilizing brace effectively turns a pistol into a rifle. For those of you who don't shoot right now, really anything that you can hook up to a pistol does not count as really a weapon piece. And that's been a longstanding, a gun aficionados have always pointed to this, to some of the, they like it, but they see it as being kind of ridiculous, why rules don't make sense. But anyway, you can turn a pistol effectively into a rifle-like device by having effectively a really long brace that kind of comes up and into your shoulder. Third, the Justice Department is going to publish a model red flag legislation that states could adopt. So obviously this wouldn't become a national law, but and then the hopes that states would do this. Fourth, an announcement that the American Jobs Plan, Ken and I were talking about a minute ago, in part would increase spending on community violence intervention programs. Fifth, have the Justice Department begin issuing an annual report on firearms trafficking. And then six, which is a rather big deal, President Biden nominated David Chipman to serve as the director of Bureau of National Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF, the first director to hold that position since 2015. So presidents often want to take immediate action. This is kind of right up my wheelhouse. So reading the executive order just kind of took me back to teaching presidency, that Halley envisioned that you wanted to bypass Congress, gets things done. And of course, they can do that through executive actions, but they're constrained, right? And we can see here, you know, most of these things that we're seeing here aren't some big, giant executive action. These are rule proposals or suggestions for states. And so they are evidence of presidents can do some things immediately, but of course, there's limits to what they can do. And even what they can do can always be undone by future presidents when they go the executive action route. So, Ken, what do you think about these proposals? I'm sure that they probably don't go far enough for you personally, but do you... I shouldn't be answering for you. You're standing right here.
No, I mean, actually, I don't know what I agree with everything you said, because there's really only a little bit that a president can actually do here. And I didn't know about this ghost gun issue, but now that I read about it, it does seem to me that that one rule may be significant, that there may actually be a significant number of people who wouldn't pass a background check, who are buying these kits, which you don't need a background check for, and then building guns.
Because they're not a weapon. They don't have a receiver. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and there, yeah, no serial number on the weapon or anything like that. And it makes it easier to use in crimes. So I feel like that rule is a significant exercise of executive authority. It seems to me like a legitimate exercise of executive authority, because it's, you know, if the types of guns that are being built are types of guns where the statutes already say there should be a background check and a serial number, then I think it's a legitimate use of executive authority to say that applies even if you build the gun yourself. I don't really think of that as like legislating so much as interpreting existing law. The other ones all seem like kind of small beer to me. Probably the nomination seems like the other one that's important, because there are some gun laws on the books, and the executive branch's job is to enforce the laws that are on the books, and they've been fairly under-enforced for a while. And so I think just getting someone in there who actually wants to enforce the existing laws could be something. But the other ones all strike me as basically nothing. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, the ghost gun is probably the biggest one. It's also going to be probably the one that has the most agitation from NRA. You know, I am a conservative libertarian. I like shoot. I'll even be honest. I shoot weapons. That's, I think sometimes there is a lot of much ado about nothing on the right when it comes to some of these proposed rule changes for average, you know, non-problematic gun owners. You know, the idea that you're going to have to, you know, have a serial number attached to your receiver, or, you know, some kind of, I mean, we don't even know what the proposed rule is going to be. I get a little frustrated with some of my colleagues who would agree with me and maybe some of the outcomes, but we disagree on some of these principles, where I would be more inclined to be with you and say, you know, I'm okay with that. Or the fact that we might want to mark, you know, have different, you know, the stabilizing braces. I understand that one as well. I mean, having had and used those kinds of things, I can say that that effectively could make a weapon a far more usable, far more easy to use in a negative way situation, those kinds of guns. Now, they haven't been generally, because I think the weapons that are often used for nefarious purposes have not often been as modified, I think, at least in my looks at it. But I agree with you in the sense that I think that's probably the one that's going to have the most potential teeth in it. And I honestly don't. It's probably time to be thinking about that kind of stuff. I wish Congress would think about this in a more holistic way. And, you know, for that last item, when we're thinking about ATF, you know, even now, as I was, you know, I was putting the show together this week and thinking about it, and it's fascinating that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms still exists, even with that name and in that format, because that's really a legacy of thinking about mobs and mobsters, right? When really, I mean, I think even the name and some of the purposes of that shows that Congress has not even attempted to have, whenever you think the legislation ought to be, they have been no attempts to modernize that legislation or that agency. Again, we don't have mobs running around today trying to bootleg, and, you know, that's not where we're seeing the gun running, and yet that's still what our, you know, that's still what our institutions are predicated on. So, you know, having a director there, I think, will be a big deal. But I think those institutional structures are, you know, probably 80 years out of date.
Yeah, so on this, we're in complete agreement on everything, I think. And one more thing, one more thing I will agree with you on. You know, I actually don't think the president should be the primary, should be trying to make the laws, you know. And I think, you know, Biden did what he could do within the structure of the law. I think the present Congress, you know, isn't going to, the votes aren't there to do much more. And I don't think he should bang his head against the wall to fail, which I think would really happen, actually, trying to work with this Congress. What I would like to see, as someone who does favor more gun control, is I'd like to see state legislatures in states that are willing to do it pass more gun control laws, and I'd like to see the federal courts leave them alone to do that, and not invent a bunch of new Second Amendment rights that were never heard of before. And you know, I think right now that if there's, you know, I can't fault President Biden though for not doing enough. I don't think there's a lot of room for him to do a lot more than what he did. And I think President Obama was in the same boat a few years back, you know, after the Sandy Hook shooting and that kind of thing. You know, he made some small executive orders like this, but there's just not room for the president to just make up gun control laws out of whole cloth.
And I need to give Biden, and you said it there, but I want to make it even more explicit. I would want to give Biden some credit on that particular front, because I think it is especially easy from the outside looking in to want presidents to do everything. Right. And to do potentially good things. Right. So, you know, whatever your predilections are, you want them to act immediately. But I think it does show signs of a mature individual, no pun intended, but you know, a thoughtful politician to say, you know, I do have limits to my power. What are the things I should be doing here? And I think the fact that he is not attempting to do everything via an executive order or go beyond the bounds of what really executive orders should look like, it could be frustrating for those who maybe have a deeper desire for more rapid change on gun policy. But I think it indicates a president who is savvy and recognizes and understands the constitutional constraints of the presidency while also trying to move the policy in a direction that he thinks is positive. And so I think this right here is a good example of where, while I don't always agree with Biden on all of his substantive policies, I can agree that he is structurally doing things that I can be okay with. And this is why, you know, I was happy voting for Biden. Was, listen, I don't necessarily agree about all his positions on gun control, but I can respect the way that he's going to push that forward. And he's going to respect the bounds of the executive office. And I think I think sometimes we don't give office holders enough credit for that. You know, we tend to idolize the big motions of like the FDRs who tried to do everything whenever they could, and the Teddy Roosevelts. But I think there's an equal case to be made for this kind of Biden motion to say, well, there are limits here as well. And I think he should be lauded for that.
So we're right on the same page on this one.
Well, see, there we go. We went from we disagree completely.
Yeah.
We're right. So why don't we move forward and talk about something else that has been vexing? At least this really is one that is, I think, part actual policy and part perception of policy, and that's the COVID passport issue, or the so-called COVID passport issue. What's been going on with this is that many countries, especially in the European Union, have been working on the so-called vaccine passport, and effectively what that is a centralized way of tracking vaccination records, or in this case, one particular vaccination record, the one related to COVID. It also oftentimes gets tied up in thoughts of technology, because many of these COVID passports are attempting to do it through digital means, meaning there'd be some more permanent, easy way to access your record via your phone, so that if you wanted to go to some kind of event or venue, and you, either your employer or perhaps, you know, the MLB wanted to have only vaccinated people or a vaccinated only location, which apparently a couple of just this past week, two baseball teams will have vaccinated sections for their ballparks. So if you'd want to be able to be in the vaccinated section, an easy way to show this. But this has really been a cultural flashpoint for many, leading two states, including Texas and Florida, to outlaw even the possibility of so-called COVID vaccines, or excuse me, COVID passports, not vaccines. The White House has already argued that there will be, quote, no federal vaccination databases, end quote, or, quote, federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential, end quote. Yet the underlying reason for wanting these vaccinations comes primarily from businesses and schools that are worried that individuals might not come if there is not evidence of people getting vaccinated. Now, this actually gets a little bit into legislation in a case that I'm always happy when I can pull out a case that I know, Ken, because I know you're like, you're the con law scholar, but I know just enough around the edges to feel kind of smart sometimes about this. Theoretically, government entities can do this, and that comes from Jacobson v. Massachusetts in 1905, where the Supreme Court ruled that a community has a right to protect itself against epidemic of disease, which threatens the safety of its members. In other words, it was upholding a law that required residents to be vaccinated or pay a fine. And I was just thinking about that, you know, in this current climate, can you imagine if a state had a get the COVID vaccine or fine you $1,000 or something. Man, like everybody would think the microchip is happening. And in our own institutions, this has come up. Rutgers started off at the week being the first institution to say they were going to require vaccinations for students. They have been followed up later this week, including today, by Brown and Cornell. And already they're working with a number of different app providers to make this the case. Israel, a country we're going to be talking about in the bonus show, Ken, already has the Green Pass, which is effectively a COVID passport. So what do you think both about the kind of the post-pandemic future when we're thinking about vaccination and who's been vaccinated, and who hasn't been vaccinated, and also kind of this is clearly becoming kind of a Mayhemian political, it's a talking point issue, whether or not it always has substance behind it as well. So kind of on both fronts, the substantive, and then as this now cultural thing that's emerging about, you know, the vaccine, the passport.
Yeah, I mean, the cultural thing kind of rolls into the substantive thing a little bit the way I think about it, because to me, you mentioned the Jacobson case from 1905. Written by the great Kentucky Justice John Marshall Harlan, who famously dissented from Plessy versus Ferguson. It's been established for a very long time that government has the constitutional authority to require people to get vaccines, and also to do things like show that you've got the vaccine, for instance, to send kids to public school or something like that. So I think substantively, you know, there's the governments definitely do have this authority if they want to pass these laws. But I think because of the, you know, certain segment of the population is very opposed to these kinds of laws and probably would violate them. You know, you do have to think that affects the wisdom of, you know, if these laws are actually passed and enforced, you know, and people are going to have to be arrested and taken to trial and things like that, or turned away, you know, what is the cure worse than the disease here, to use a metaphor? And I wonder about it, because, you know, especially if they can get the vaccine rolled out to children, which it seems to be on the way. I know
as a matter of fact, Pfizer just asked to do it to 12 to 18.
Yeah, because I think right now the best justifications for right now that I can think of for why states should really throw their weight around would be to protect children who can't get vaccinated and who would be getting the disease from people. But if we get to a point where children can also get vaccinated, and then the only people out there in public who aren't vaccinated, you know, they're running their own risk that they're going to get the disease. It's not going to bother anybody else if they do. Then at that point, I'd said rather just let them have the liberty to get the disease if they want it. You know, yeah. I'm not going to get the disease. I'm fully vaccinated. You know, and I think at a certain point, it doesn't help. It doesn't accomplish anything to try to use the force of law against people to save them from themselves, from their own stupid decisions. Even where I think that I do believe, as a constitutional law matter, the governments would have the power to do that. They'd be within their authority to do all that. But I'm not sure I see the wisdom of it, except for the purpose right now of protecting children who don't have that option. You know, I think right now they don't have the option to get vaccinated, and they shouldn't be forced to if they want to go to the Cubs game to run the risk of getting COVID because they can't get the vaccine yet.
Yeah. Well, and this for one of the things about the vaccination that has run an interest has run a gamut has been at the beginning of the debate over vaccines before we got to COVID. It was really ironically kind of a California, a little more left leaning issue. And it always kind of baffled me that that's where, you know, it started. But it was weird to have, you know, a lot of Republicans going like, what's up with all of these like crunchy leftists who they want their kids to get the measles? And, you know, we had, you know, there was some outbreaks in the Pacific Northwest, which is, I guess, one of the things that has always concerned me. We don't really know what's going to happen with herd immunity when you have the outliers that you talk about. You know, one possibility is that more like the flu vaccine, that it won't impact individuals who've had it. But of course, there's always a chance of failure. And, you know, what's that percentage rate and how does that work out? It looks positive. And, you know, I hope we are now both vaccinated. So we're rolling the dice the way I'd want to do it. Right. We were talking about the show began. I'm two weeks out. Right. Like, so, you know, so if somebody decides to cough into the ventilation system, I should be OK. but, you know, and then, you know, it moves, it shifts. And so then once you get to the post, once you get to COVID, suddenly all of the anti-vaxxers, the original anti-vaxxers have shifted and they're, oh, it was time for the vaccine, which kind of shocked me. Where at the same time, everybody who was going, you need to get the measles vaccine is now saying, I don't know about the science on this. And it's been a weird, it has, in other words, it has shifted spectrums and political ideologies in a way that I was not anticipating. And so now that we have this passport, it's one of these things, it's not quite as easily. You keep thinking it might be a left-right thing, but it keeps, like a disease, it keeps morphing and infecting different ideological strands. So that's the other element to this that I think that is unique.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of that till you said it, but it is true that anti-vaxxing, I think, did start mainly in the left, and it did shift over certainly to the Trump wing of the right. Now, I think there are, particularly in communities like the African American community, there's still some anti-vaxxerism on the left there as well. It hasn't completely disappeared from the left, although I think it's disappeared from the college educated sort of, you know, progressive left, I guess. But
yeah.
I suppose people who are just feel like they don't trust the powers that be. I think there's a link between that and being suspicious of getting a vaccine. And, you know, maybe just depending on who's on the ins and who's on the outs, that's when the left or the right, you know, you get the switches between who's the one that doesn't trust the powers that be.
That's true. And, you know, that kind of feeds into that idea of conspiracy theories and who's kind of out to get you. And, you know, at some point we should do maybe a topical bonus show where we talk about conspiracy theories. Yeah. That's right up my wheelhouse. Maybe we should do that sometime. But maybe we should move on. Yeah. Okay. So you're on board too. Okay. Well, listen, we'll have to do, you know, let us know, on Discord of what you guys think about that. One last thing that we want to get to before the close of the show out is that this Friday, President Biden signed an executive order impaneling a commission to examine the Supreme Court and other federal judiciary reforms. Now, among many on the left, and this has been a topic of conversation between you and me, Ken, have wanted to see some changes on the Supreme Court after Ginsburg was replaced by Amy Barrett. Trump, of course, was able to end up replacing three Supreme Court nominees. And the last, at the last possible moment is Barrett. And I think that was seen. I don't think it was seen as a steal by many on the left after the rhetoric of Republicans holding up the Obama appointee as we moved into the Trump. As you might recall, you know, Republicans wanted to hold that seat open because they thought that theoretically, they argued that the election should decide who's going to get to make that nomination. At the time, I argued personally that that was dumb for Republicans to argue. the majority controls, they should just make that argument and say, we control, we get to do what they do. They didn't go my way because for whatever reason, they don't pay me or employ me, you know. So anyway, they didn't pay any attention. But then when it came around, this then required them to awkwardly kind of flip their narrative language and say, well, it's not, well, we've already won the election. You know, we don't have to wait for Biden to take office. And so liberal activists, one response to this has been increasing the size of the court. So along with President Biden's executive order creating a commission, the progressive group Demand Justice continued to up the ante and the pressure on Biden by launching what they're calling the Breyer Retire campaign, arguing it's time for Justice Breyer to step down. Now, this is something that Biden has says he's not interested in, not in replacing Breyer, but in specifically changing the size of the court. And Breyer, who is 82 and appointed by President Bill Clinton in 94, argued that liberal groups shouldn't take that path. They shouldn't go down the route of kind of monkeying with the structural changes to the federal court or specifically to the Supreme Court. Recently in his talk to Harvard Law School, he said that the purpose of his talk was to, quote, make those whose initial instincts may favor important structural changes, such as forms of court packing, think long and hard before embodying those changes in law, end quote. Now, historically, you know, we're kind of still on the par, but I understand why I think Republicans Democrats are a little upset. Now, just for a little history lesson, Washington still holds the record for the most ever Supreme Court nominees. He gets 12 successful nominations. But in the modern era, 2 to 4 is a typical number. So it wasn't like Trump had a ton more than his predecessors. You know, Reagan had 4. George H.W. Bush had 2. Clinton had 2. George W. had 2. Obama had 2. And then finally, Trump ends up getting 3. And then I was thinking about it as people talked about the age of Breyer. You know, he's 82. Maybe it's time for him to step down. But of course, Joe Biden is 78, so it might be hard for him to be like, listen, Breyer, you got to retire, man. You're just too old. Especially if he's thinking about running for re-election, because he'd be running for re-election at the same age. He'd be asking Breyer to step down, which is another weird, you know, circumstance. So what do you think about, this is your area, right? Yeah.
Reagan only got 3, not 4. And Trump only had 1 term. So getting 3 in 1 term is like getting 6 for 2 terms. So that's a highly disproportionate
number. I guess that's true. I was just thinking in terms of each president, but you're right. They are different in the number they had. But of course, you know, H.W. Bush only had 1 term as well. So I was being equally,
H.W. Bush,
and he got in 2, that sense. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, H.W. Bush got 2.
He had 2 in 1 term.
And then both Clinton and Obama only had 2 apiece across 2 terms. So that's only 1 per term. On the bigger issue, I believe that Breyer will be retiring this summer. And I don't think it's that crazy of an ask for Biden to ask for that, because even though, as you said, they're the same age, the difference is that Biden has a 4-year term. Supreme Court justice has life tenure,
right?
And life tenure is not worth as much at that age, you know, as it would be for somebody much younger. And I think even Breyer's got to believe that Ruth Bader Ginsburg made a big mistake hanging on as long as she did. And although I do believe that seat was stolen, nonetheless, it wouldn't have been able to be stolen if she would have retired when Obama was still president, which she certainly should have done. So I actually think that's a subtext in Breyer's remarks at Harvard this week. I think when Breyer goes and makes a speech at Harvard against court packing, against doing things crazy, changing the structure of the court, I actually think there's a subtext in that he's saying, you don't have to do that. I am going to retire. You can replace me. Biden will get to make a nomination this summer, even without doing all this crazy stuff. So I think that he will. I also agree with Justice Breyer's point. I'm not in favor of expanding the Supreme Court beyond 9. And I did a special with Michael one time where we talked through all this stuff. So I'm on record on the Politics Guys saying that. We did a special Supreme Court special for the subscriber show. But what I think is that this commission can do is suggest a number of very good ideas, probably none of which will get codified into law, because most of these ideas can't be done without, if they're filibusterable.
Right.
So these are not spending items that can be done on reconciliation. So the only real way that any of this commission's ideas could get codified into law would be either if 10 Republicans go along with it, which seems very unlikely, or if the Dems break the filibuster, which seems similarly unlikely, I think, at this point. So,
well, now you've had, three Democrats now come out and say that they are not in favor of that.
Was it? I thought it was only Manchin and Sinema. Is there a third?
I thought there were. I'm gonna check myself there. I might have said three, maybe it's just two.
But Manchin doubled down again on it this week. He made a fresh round of statements that he's not going to break the
filibuster. Could have just been I was seeing it for a new time and I'm counting it wrong.
Think it's not going to happen. So I guess the value of a commission like this to me, and I think it's valuable, but it's within that limited range of the kind of executive orders that we're talking about. It's just going to, you know, get people talking about things. It's going to generate ideas. It's not really going to come into law, but I think there are some structural changes that would be beneficial. I don't think expanding Supreme Court size is one of them. I do think expanding the size of the appellate court, the circuit courts, would be one of them. Those have been expanded a number of times in the past. There's nothing magical about the numbers of judges that sit on the circuit courts. And in fact, the caseloads have increased quite a lot since the last time those numbers were increased. And, you know, the Supreme Court, their case law never increases because they get to decide what cases to take. But the circuit courts have to take all these cases. So I think there's good justification for expanding those. I think there's some justification, and people have talked about this, for that even though all federal judges, including Supreme Court justices, get life tenure, that doesn't necessarily mean it's unconstitutional to rotate them off the Supreme Court. Right. So there's some proposals for that, to have a fixed term of years on the Supreme Court, after which the Supreme Court justice, they don't have to retire. They're still a federal judge, but they'd be rotated down to a circuit court or a federal district court. So that's a proposal people have talked about. I think it would be constitutional. It hasn't been done before. But I think these kind of discussions are good because they keep people thinking about the role of the Supreme Court. Public opinion could change in ways that would, you know, if there ends up being any kind of bipartisan support in public opinion, then in the long run, that could lead to some bipartisan support in Congress, not in the immediate run, I don't think. And also, I think it exerts a little pressure on the court. And one of the most interesting things that I think we've been seeing this term in the Supreme Court is that, you know, after all the concern about Trump appointing three justices and Barrett stealing the seat, and these are all concerns I very much shared, I think as I watch the behavior of the current court, the Trumpy justices on the court right now are Thomas and Alito, the ones that Trump didn't appoint. You know, those are the Trumpy justices on the court. And if you look at the actual behavior of Amy Coney Barrett or even Brett Kavanaugh on the court, who were the two that had the most controversial confirmation hearings, you know, Gorsuch's was a relatively smooth sail compared to them. They're behaving, you know, in the John Roberts mold. They're not really behaving like Trumpy justices at all. And I think that partly is because of all the public attention. Now, it may also be because the Federalist Society types who chose them really weren't all that Trumpy. And so you're seeing like a little bit of a difference, you know, in terms of what Trump thought he was getting and what he actually got.
I think right there, you've hit the nail on the head right there, right? I mean, he made a promise that he was going to, you know, you get me into office, I'm going to make sure you get your nominees. And I think one of the things that probably went a little bit unnoticed on the left was why they still don't agree. You know, these weren't Trump people. This was Trump saying, I'm going to do this so that he can have power. That's all he cared about. He didn't care about these nominees. He cared about the issue of the Supreme Court only because it gave him a way to try to get more moderate Republicans on board with his more radical nomination, to scare them into what would be the nominee if you would have had a Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I mean, the one and the only thing that I think that he did that, you know, kind of advanced a lot of conservative agendas in a more traditional way was electing, nominating these individuals and getting them appointed. But you're right. The idea that they were going to be somehow like mini Trumps, that was never going to be the case.
It's not happening. And I think Alito is the closest to that on the court, and he's not a Trump appointee. Yeah. So I think you had a center right court already, and it's still a center right court. It hasn't become a far right court.
Yeah.
So that's interesting too, I think. But I think that is, you know, maybe it wouldn't happen anyhow because of who these justices are. But I also think it helps, you know, if Biden does things like put this commission in and the commission's always talking about the court, I think that that level of being in a fishbowl for the court will help keep it in the center right rather than moving to the far right. So I think that's good also.
Well, and, you know, that's that will be something worth seeing. You know, the court has generally wanted to not be in the light, right? They don't want to have things talking or doing about them because a lot of their power comes from that mystery mystique, that, you know, like we wear the robes and we don't let cameras in and we do these kinds of things. So you're right. If this becomes a talking point that gets taken up and actually gets some attention, then that might make some changes. You know, as a scholar of political communication, I don't think, you know, commissions like this generally, you know, they make a little bit of a splash when they happen. They sometimes make a little bit of a splash when they find something or they make some kind of report. But I wouldn't be betting, you know, if you were asking me, you know, what's the amount of what's the amount of media attention this is going to get hereafter? You know, I'd be shorting them. I would, you know,
I agree with that. But the one caveat I'd make to that is it's the Supreme Court. You know, they also care about attention from the legal community, from the legal academic community. It's not only attention from Fox News.
OK, right? I was thinking you meant from like voters.
Well, for different constituencies, right? Different constituencies, yeah. I think the Supreme Court is as responsive to some esoteric constituencies as to the general public, right?
Okay,
so all of those things can put some pressure on the Supreme Court.
Okay, and on that, there's his truth to that. Well, Ken, it's been a lot of fun doing the show with you and, you know, trying some new things out. So I hope this has been fun.
Yeah, we did it on Zoom instead of Skype today. So
that's right.
Tell us if it sounds right, and we should wish, although they may listen any day, we should wish them all a happy Potomac Courthouse Day. Today is the anniversary of the day.
Didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Well, and that's true. You know, I want to thank everybody for listening, but I also want to let you know, yes, we're doing a little bit of an experiment today. So for supporters, you're going to get a chance. Potentially, we'll see how this all works out. But if it all works out, you're going to get to see myself and Ken on a video vlog podcast version of it. I don't know, whatever the kids are calling it these days, a vlog. So if you're interested in that, you know, we always at the end of the show always ask for support. And whether this works out awesome or not, one of the great things is we have some really just phenomenal supporters. And one of the things you're going to definitely get one way or the other is our full length supporters only Wednesday show. And so as soon as we get done with this, we're going to move on to that. We're going to be talking about that big Amazon union vote. We're going to talk about a dissent. We're kind of taking a look at Oracle v. Google. We're going to talk about some of the crazy sex lives of Florida congressmen. You know, why is it always to be Florida? Right? Florida man runs for office and then Vimo's, you know, sex money. Well, we're going to be talking about that on the show. So if you are interested in any of that, you're going to gain access to those things by becoming a supporter. We also, and I've mentioned it in the show, we have the Discord channel. And if you'd like to chat with me or Mike, as a matter of fact, some of the things I was going to do in the show, or I was kind of thinking about, I was sharing it on the Discord channel. It's been a lot of fun to kind of engage in that. So I would love for you to be part of the Discord. So if you want to become a supporter or you want to learn about the other benefits of supporting the Politics Guys, you can actually check out our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/politicsguys. That's patreon.com/politicsguys. Or you can just go over to politicsguys.com/support. So join me and Ken again on Wednesday for our bonus show where we follow Florida man and all of the crazy things he does by heading to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or just a random thought you'd like to share with me, Ken, or any of the other Politics Guys, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Marino, Andra Masker, Nathan Sosnowski, Daniel Toe, and Chris Wilkinson. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff. We'll be back with a new show. I hope you'll join us then.